Welcome to the Unconquered Podcast.
One of the issues with our team right now is mental toughness, discipline, and execution.
Blame no one. Make no excuses. Do something.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Unconquered Podcast. As always, Jason Staples here. Going to talk quarterbacks today. Recorded a good portion of this, actually, at the same time that I recorded the episode that I released first, that I released on Friday. But the reason I didn't want to put all this in there is that that one was already running in an hour. And so I decided, you know what, let's go ahead and make a second episode just about the quarterback situation itself, where we can talk about DeAndre Francois, where we can talk about a number of possible subjects there that come up with the quarterback position. So let's go ahead and get to that. Also have a few questions to answer. Before I do that, I want to go ahead and turn it over to our special guest to discuss at least one of our sponsors here.
Hi, I'm Troy McClure. You may remember me from such educational films as 2 - 3 = -Fun and Firecrackers, The Silent Killer. I'm here to talk to you today about the new initiative from the Unconquered Podcast, the Unconquered Podcast Network of Realtors. You've all been amazed by the photography and videography of Luis Marquez from Keller Williams Realty in Jacksonville, Florida. Well, prepare to have your mind blown by other realtors in other regions, all connected by the tradition of excellence represented by the Unconquered Podcast. The latest addition to this stable of thoroughbreds is Eric Rostad from Keller Williams Realty in Nashville, Tennessee, and the surrounding areas. Eric is tireless and will make sure you get the best possible experience in buying or selling your home. It doesn't even matter how many aquariums you may have. More to come soon. Just remember, the best realtors are Unconquered Realtors.
Thank you, Mr. McClure, for your tremendous service. And now we get back to discussing the Florida State recruiting 2019 recruiting class. And the first thing we need to talk about that I didn't talk really a whole lot about on the last podcast, because I wanted to talk about who they actually signed and really get that out of the way. And again, by Sunday afternoon or so, I should have several videos up on the Patreon page dealing with some video breakdowns and so on of how I'm looking at evaluating certain things. But we'll go ahead and get to some of the things about the recruiting class itself, in terms of who they didn't sign and some big picture stuff in this episode. And that, first of all, before we even start there, I want to discuss something that I haven't discussed since it happened on this podcast. And that is the departure of DeAndre Francois. We've been talking on this podcast that I didn't expect, based on what I'd been told, that Francois was going to be around for next season anyway. But given the situation in terms of recruiting, given the depth situation, I was starting to think it looked a little more likely, and that they wouldn't necessarily force him to leave, even though he might not have been the starter. And here's the thing. If Francois had been back and had not been the starter, I'm quite confident that he would have poisoned that locker room even more, that he would have done everything he could to undermine James Blackman. I mean, just think about what he did via social media and all sorts of other stuff, the poison that he put out when Blackman was the starter the first time. And you're talking about a guy who was injured. He couldn't play. And that's why Blackman was out there. And there he is doing everything he can to undermine the guy that replaced him. So tell you what, this, in my view, obviously not something to just take lightly in terms of the video that was released on Instagram. And if those of you who haven't seen it, you know, his longtime girlfriend, on and off girlfriend, released a video in which he was threatening to hit her in the face again, because she had thrown some stuff in his house and all this. And you know, it doesn't show him, but it's his voice on the tape or on the recording. And, you know, obviously you need to take any sort of domestic violence very seriously. And, you know, that goes without saying. This is not a situation where it's, you know, good for you for kicking him off. This is the only choice you had, especially since it was like his 30th strike in the program. You know, he already had enough strikes under Jimbo to potentially be gone. And then he got the deck reset when Willie got to town. And, you know, Taggart gave him every opportunity to reform and do things the right way. And he continued to collect strikes. So, and I'm not talking about foul balls. I'm talking about, you know, stuff that, well, you know, you're not hurting, you're not helping your team. And you know, as far as I'm concerned, Francois, what, yes, he was in a bad situation with a bad offensive line, all sorts of different things. But in my view, he was a bad seed in the program and was producing bad fruit by this point and was replicating. You know, this is not to say that nobody in that locker room was on Francois' side. The thing is, you don't want those guys in your locker room. And in my view, this winds up being major addition by subtraction. Yeah, it puts you in a dangerous spot where you've only got one right now eligible scholarship quarterback on the roster. But to me, that's preferable to having two where one of them is a guy who's going to do everything he can to undermine the other and then isn't good enough to sacrifice. I mean, listen, if you're going to be that much of a problem, then you'd better be a Heisman caliber, NFL caliber guy. And he's just not. So, and even at that, I don't think it's worth the poison that he was in the locker room. So to me, getting him out in this context where, you know, it's a no-brainer, no question. And it's also a good thing to get clarity this early so that they know going into spring that, you know, this is their situation and they can plan accordingly. And basically they are where they need to be in that regard. So, to me, that's a positive, even though it leaves you in a more dangerous place in terms of numbers. I think you're in a more dangerous place. If the closer he is to being on the roster in the fall, the more dangerous that is. So to me, that's a win for the program. That's a plus. And good luck to DeAndre, and I hope he gets things squared away and straight down the line. And obviously his girlfriend then put up something else on Instagram, basically apologizing for the whole thing and saying that, you know, no, he didn't hit her and everything, but she was doing this as a ploy to try to get him back and didn't understand that it would ruin his life. And to me, I call BS on all that she didn't understand the implications of what she was doing. Come on, let's be real. She did. She understood. But even if that's the case, even if he never did hit her, the things he was saying to her are the sorts of things you know, if that comes to light, you got to boot a kid for. Sorry. No, I'm actually sorry, not sorry. And at the end of the day, you know, if she was as problematic to him as he has said in the past, then that's on you for choosing her. It's not like you don't have other options in Tallahassee as a football player. I mean, come on. That just reflects the kind of decision making that you've seen from Francois in all sorts of other respects. So, and I will say, I mean, I actually kind of believe that he didn't ever hit her because, I mean, even if he tried, I'm not sure that he would have a hit rate of over 50% anyway. So, you know, maybe he did try and just missed. I don't know, but at any rate, to me, this is a plus for the program. It's addition by subtraction, and it allows them to move forward in terms of trying to rebuild culture without that guy trying to be selfish and continuing to inject that kind of selfish mentality within the program. Because teams take on the personality of their coach, and the coach puts his personality, his stamp on the team through his quarterback. Quarterbacks accountability, set the personality of the team as much as anybody, as much as anything. And when you've got a selfish guy at the quarterback position, that kind of filters and festers and does all that stuff through the program. So to me, this is the excision of a malignancy in the on the team, and may have a little bit of short-term impact that could be negative. You know, if Blackman goes down, then, you know, maybe your replacement doesn't play quite as well, but actually you wonder whether or not this is a situation where even if his numbers were better, whether or not the guy who would replace him as the second string guy would actually still be better, because the rest of the team, you know, that guy's making the rest of the team better rather than, you know, how things might be with Francois still on the roster. So let's go ahead and wash our hands of that and talk about then the fact that basically this staff for the second year in a row failed to sign a high school quarterback, which is kind of amazing. You know, that's the elephant in the room we have to talk about right away. You can't afford not to sign quarterbacks. My view is that you need to sign a quarterback every year, minimum. Really, ideally, in my view, you sign about 1.5 quarterbacks per year. So you sign two every other year and one in the year that you don't sign two. What you can't do is come up empty. And one of the reasons is, well, number one, we've seen the last few years, look at who Florida State has signed at that position really since Jameis Winston. And it's been really it's been actually shocking how difficult it's been to get top quarterbacks to want to come to Tallahassee since Jameis Winston. And actually, I think there's something to that in terms of normally programs are able to really build on winning a national title, the benefit of a Heisman Trophy winner and all of that. But because of all the negative press that followed Jameis Winston, I know for a fact that Florida State had some trouble early on in those first couple years after that with parents and some others, and that there was some definite negative recruiting and other things going on in terms of being able to attract some of those players. And also with Jameis winning the Heisman as a redshirt freshman, that immediate next year, it was almost impossible to get players interested because, you know, it's try getting an elite guy to Clemson. Well, actually, you know what? Come to think of it, they did a pretty good job this year with that. Well, amazing. Now, that said, I mean, this was a weak year for quarterbacks as it was. And, you know, the kid that they signed, they're probably going to end up recruiting over anyway. But, you know, he's not an elite kid. He's a good player. But a kid that Florida State actually passed on largely in favor of Sam Howell. So and that obviously didn't work out. But all you have to do is look at Florida State's quarterbacks signed since Jameis Winston. I mean, the list is not encouraging. I mean, really, Florida State's quarterback position has been the Spinal Tap drummer of FBS, of the FBS since Winston. I mean, you think about, look at who Fisher signed before leaving, and then the fact that Florida State hasn't signed a quarterback since. Jeez, you got John Franklin in 2013, and that's a guy that really they signed knowing that they had Winston. They thought they'd have Winston an extra year after that, but basically a kid that, if he doesn't work out a quarterback, he moves somewhere else. No, didn't work out. J.J. Cosentino, 2014, total whiff. Kid looked the part, ball looked great coming off his hand, just never had it mentally. DeAndre Johnson, he was the guy that was the safe pick. They took DeAndre Francois, who everybody wanted, remember, a top recruit, what, the number two pro style recruit in the country, DeAndre Francois. But then but there were some potential character issues there. You know, he was thought of as aloof and all that. So they took a second guy with that, and that's what you need to do. Every other class you should take two. So they took DeAndre Johnson, who, you know, as the character pick, guy that, you know, maybe not as physically talented, but, you know, very good, stable prospect and all that, and turned out to be the one that was out first for punching a woman. And that was unpredictable, by the way. I mean, everybody in recruiting circles thought the world of DeAndre Johnson and his character and all of that. So, I mean, totally unpredictable. The next one, less unpredictable, Malik Henry. What an absolute mess that was. So all of a sudden you go, basically, you go Franklin, Cosentino, Johnson, Francois, Henry in a row. Wow. And then Bailey Hockman and James Blackman after Malik Henry in the class of 2017. So again, that's good. You got your supposed stud in 2016, and then you get your two kids in the next class. So you're staggering one and then two. That's fine. But then Henry flames out. Johnson punches a woman. Francois, well, you know, he's Francois. And then Hockman transfers when he doesn't feel like he gets a fair shake from the new Taggart staff when they come in from the new staff. And all you got left is one guy on campus from that entire series. You got James Blackmon, who, listen, Blackmon's a good player. He's a good prospect, and especially as he continues to add some weight, gets a little bit more physically there, he's a guy that can play, and he's a really good leader. He's what you want at the position. But dang, man. And then you don't sign two quarterbacks in the two classes following that? That's bad. That is bad. There's no denying that. That said, the look, the appearance of it all is actually worse than the reality in many respects. And that's because they actually, depending on how you look at this, yeah, they didn't sign a quarterback out of high school last year. But Jordan Travis was one of their targets last year, who went to Louisville, and now he's on the roster. Now, he's probably not going to be eligible for 2019, and that's the real issue. But he's a guy that basically, in terms of the future, you plug in as your 2018 recruit. He is that. So long term, you did sign a kid in the 2018 class. You just got him a year later, and he's not likely. I mean, it's possible that he's eligible to be a backup in 2019. And if he is eligible, if he gets the waiver to be eligible in 2019, all of this is pretty much moot, because then you've got two talented quarterbacks with some degree of experience who've been through spring, who know the offense, to be able to play. And then you can basically do what you want to with Blackmon, and it's not a total catastrophic situation, not a complete catastrophe if Blackmon goes down, because you've got Travis. You know, Blackmon goes down for a game, well, Travis can come in. But if Travis isn't there, it's pretty disastrous, because Blackman's the only scholarship quarterback you have on roster at this point. Now, that said, it's not going to be a whole lot better if you do land a Lance Lejeune, if he's actually eligible, if he was going to make it into school. It's not a whole lot better to play a true freshman who is a non-early enrollee in that situation. I mean, that's still an emergency. You're still going to lose a lot of games. But the main thing is, for the future, you've got to sign that guy. You got to sign a guy in each class at the quarterback position, because again, look at the last few years, and you need to have enough numbers to make sure that if and when one of the guys transfers, you don't have a big hole. So, you know, they're going to need to find a way to get a transfer in to provide some depth, but that's tricky, because, you know, what grad transfer is going to want to come in and be a backup? And then if you bring a grad transfer in and he wins the job, then you run the risk of Blackmon being upset and that potentially submarines the future. So this is not a very friendly situation quarterback wise for the present. Now, that said, it's a 2019 problem, because again, Travis is on the roster. Jordan Travis is on the roster. So in 2020, presumably you still have James Blackmon on the roster. James Blackman's probably your incumbent starter. And, you know, having taken a red shirt last year, he's now going to be a red shirt sophomore. He has the 2020 year as a red shirt junior. And then you've got Jordan Travis, who then would be basically a red shirt sophomore, having sat out the 2019 season and redshirted the 2018 season. So now he's a redshirt sophomore behind the redshirt junior. You've got a nice stagger there. And then, you know, if Blackmon shows out, that's great. And if he shows out and moves on, that's great. That means you had success. If, you know, Travis somehow blows up and ends up taking the job, then fine. But that's unlikely, again, by the way. Again, the more experienced guy there, probably going to maintain that job, especially since he skill-wise, in terms of his ability to throw down the field and all that, fits well with what Riles wants to do. But ultimately, you're okay there. And then you bring in a Jeff Sims in the 2020 class, and now you have a redshirt junior, a redshirt sophomore, and a very talented redshirt sophomore. I like Jordan Travis's potential and talent a lot, especially in the system that they're going to be running. So That's good. And then you have Jeff Sims as the 2020 freshman. So you actually have some degree of depth. Now, you want to add actually a second guy in that 2020 class. I've seen some people saying, oh, you need to add a third guy now. Now you need to sign three guys in the 2020 class. No, you don't want to do that, actually. You want to sign two. You sign three, and then you can't sign somebody. Nobody's going to want to come in the 2021 class. So you sign two guys. If Jeff Sims is going to be the guy you're going to bank on, now you go after a kid that maybe isn't being recruited by the highest level ever. You've got to find a kid that wants to come in and compete and be a reliable option if somebody goes down or if somebody transfers, somebody that has upside that can compete. That's what you want in that second guy. Now, and again, I like Jeff Sims enough that I'm not real worried about that. Once he's on campus, I'm not real worried because I'd have taken, I'll tell you this, if Jeff Sims were able to reclassify and be a 2019 recruit, I'd have taken him over John Reese Plumlee or Lance, wait for it, Lejeune. I would have taken him over either of those guys. I think he's a really good prospect. I like his, he's got an easy release. Ball comes out of his hand nicely, throws it downfield well, and has the ability to move and run sort of along similar lines to what you see with Plumlee. He's a better overall runner than Lejeune, who is a little bit, he's a little bigger and runs a little heavier. He's a good runner, but he's a little heavier in that regard. I like Jeff Sims a lot. I think he's a really, really good pull for this staff for the 2020 class. And he also gives you a kid that can be your bell cow. If you have a top level quarterback that kids like, that's well connected, especially in state, that can be your quarterback from before signing day, the year before, and that's the guy that's recruiting for you from day one, that's huge. I mean, that was one of the problems actually with Florida State's 2019 class is Sam Howell was not, he's a top rated quarterback in the class. Again, not of the same kind of can't miss type caliber as some of the top quarterbacks in the prior class. But when you have a quarterback committed, you really need that guy to be, even if he's not really publicly a, gregarious guy and out there on social media all the time. And you need him to be a bell cow for your class and at least quietly behind the scenes recruiting to try to really get people together. And Sam Howell wasn't doing that even when he was committed. And that was one of the problems with the 2019 class. Well, now you get a Jeff Sims in, and Sims appears to be a kid that's going to be recruiting from day one. That really helps that 2020 class a lot. So That just prefacing all of this in terms of 2019 with that they'll be okay once Jordan Travis is actually cleared to play, whether that's in 20, if that's in 2019, then my concerns are more or less alleviated for 2019 because it would take two quarterbacks going down for real disaster. And at that point, any team is going to have disaster. But the real problem is that in 2019 right now, as things stand, if James Blackmon goes down, Florida State's screwed. But once Jordan Travis is eligible and once Jeff Sims is on campus, they should be okay. It's the stuff until then that's more the problem. And I'm not sure that Lance Lejeune would have actually made that big of a difference in the short term, just because of the problems that come when you play a true freshman anyway. So that a true freshman that's not an elf. So again, it's all about surviving 2019 and making sure that Blackmon is protected. And, again, ideally, Jordan Travis is cleared. I don't think that's very likely, but, it's possible. And if that happens, not a big deal. So that's the big thing that everybody's obviously talking about. And, that's the elephant in the room. But really, anytime you're recruiting a quarterback, for the most part, you're dealing with the future and not the immediate need. So, yeah, there was an immediate need at Florida State, but really that needs to be met by finding somebody that's willing to come in and compete and probably not be the starter. Blackmon's probably going to be the starter, but basically find a way to finesse that situation to make sure that you have a little bit of depth. Because it's the 2019 season that really is a concern there. But ultimately, they do need to find somebody in the transfer portal as a graduate transfer, somebody that's going to be eligible right away that can come in and at least provide depth. But again, and actually, I've gotten some questions about this. I mean, one question Quentin asked me, what are my thoughts on how Nick Starkle would fit in at Florida State? Nick Starkle, the quarterback from Texas A&M, who is now transferring. He's got 2 years to play too as a graduate transfer, going to be eligible right away. And, you know, would he fit? Well, yeah, I mean, he could play. He could play in the system. Would he be a great fit in the system? Not really. He was the less mobile guy at Texas A&M, more of a pocket guy. But could he play in the system? Absolutely. Yeah, he could be good. He could be fine. But there are a couple factors in here that make it a little trickier. One is Starkle is leaving Texas A&M in large measure because he got beat out by a younger guy. Do you really think that he wants to transfer to Florida State, where he has 2 years to play two, and he's got a guy behind him who has 3 years to play three, who is basically an incumbent in James Blackman, who's probably going to be the starter? Would you make that call? So to me, I don't see Starkle making that choice. Now, he has been in contact with Florida State, and I'm sure they're gonna let him know that the job is open. And, you know, if they can persuade him, then that's one thing. But then the next thing is, if you're James Blackman and they bring in a guy that has 2 years to play too, what do you think? Are you potentially thinking about hitting the portal? So, I mean, this is where it gets tricky. I mean, you kind of have to bring in a graduate transfer who would be content not being the starter, which then you wonder why the guy would be a graduate transfer and want to go there. Or you're going to risk potentially causing a problem for Blackman again. So it is a sensitive situation, and that makes things much more difficult for Taggart and the coaching staff in terms of how they can move forward in terms of the 2019 season. Because, I mean, Starkle would not be an upgrade on Blackman as a starter, in my view. Actually, I think Blackman probably a little bit better on that front, especially since he's been in a system that was very, very similar to what they're running last year. I mean, a lot of the stuff they're doing, I mean, it's very, very much the same. So yeah, he's a guy that could fit, guy that could come in and help, but is he a guy that's gonna want to make that call, and how would Blackman respond? Those are the tricky questions. Now, I've also gotten some other questions, and I want to go ahead and address some of those. Brian asked, do you think Willie Taggart thought it would be a lot easier to recruit elite players to Florida State than it turned out to be, since he was considered a great recruiter? And I think the answer to this is a resounding yes. I think that, again, Taggart has recruited well wherever he's gone. You know, he had Oregon in a place where they were poised to sign a top 5 to 10 class. I mean, they were number one at one point when he was there in terms of ranking. Now, they weren't going to finish number one, but they were going to finish as high as highly as they ever have. You know, he's a guy, he knows, he's known how to close. He's been a good recruiter wherever he's gone. And then you go to a place that's historically been the easiest place to recruit in the country, going back into the 90s. I mean, Florida State, this class was, I think, the lowest ranked class that they've had in terms of, that they've signed in terms of the services, since they started ranking these things in the modern recruiting era. So going back to about like 03 or 04, I think it's in that range. So you're looking at a program that just has never recruited, never had any trouble recruiting. So if you're a coach that's been a good recruiter, and then you know that you're going to be putting a logo on your chest that's going to make it even easier, yeah, you're expecting to get elite guys. And I actually think that's something that affected Jimbo Fisher and his staff late under Jimbo Fisher. And actually, I want to bring in another question that I think is worth addressing alongside this. And that is, and this is from Eric, where he said, I don't mean to beat a dead horse as far as Jimbo goes, but how the heck did he strike out so much, ruining our chemistry on recruiting with regard to character? Did he not care, or was it a perfect storm of personalities that happened to sign at the same time? Well, first of all, I can tell you this, Jimbo did care about that. Now, and anybody who tells you otherwise is either lying or they never talked to him. So, I mean, I can tell you that with some degree of authority and confidence that Jimbo did care about that. And actually, again, going back to the quarterbacks, you know, you get people that say, oh, Jimbo just didn't care about signing character quarterbacks. Look at the guys he signed. Well, you know, that it's easier to say in hindsight than in foresight, because everybody in the country was recruiting DeAndre Francois. Sometimes guys just don't respond well when they get to college. Now, yeah, he was understood to be kind of a different dude, but character problems, that wasn't really the read on him coming out. And then DeAndre Johnson was widely regarded as a really high character guy, two-parent family, really, you know, upstanding, did all the right things, you know, super hard worker, had a great rep in high school. And then he's the first guy to get kicked off for punching a woman in a bar, which, I mean, it was shocking to anybody who had ever talked to him, anybody who knew anything about him in the recruiting process. And then you look at Malik Henry, and yeah, Henry had some clear red flags. But remember, Henry was in a class that was following signing Francois and Johnson, and Jimbo flat out told me while he was recruiting Henry, and I'll try to quote as close as I can to his words, but he told me that that Henry was the best prospect that he'd recruited since Jameis. And you know, he said, you know, when he was at camp, and here's what he said. That sucker was seeing things faster than I was at times. And, you know, that was one of the tests that Jimbo has in terms of he likes to see kids come into camp and he likes to see how quickly they process and do all that, throws a couple different things at him in 7-on-7 and just sees how quickly they respond. And he said, you know, standing behind him, that sucker saw stuff. Sometimes he'd be getting rid of the ball as fast, you know, faster than I'd see stuff. And, you know, he felt like Henry, yeah, was a little bit of a risk, but, you know, he felt like, well, a couple of things in terms of that had happened at IMG and, you know, some of the personality stuff. Yeah, he's young, you know, get him here. But, you know, maybe he's worth taking the risk because of the elite level of talent. And that was kind of Jimbo's philosophy on a lot of this, is that you only take a risk on an elite kid. And he also had, this was something that Jimbo told me years ago as well. This is maybe 2009 maybe, where, you know, he'd said, and maybe 2011, it doesn't matter, but where he'd said that he had a philosophy on basically you can bring in one or two knuckleheads a class that you can take a gamble on where you know that they're potential problems. And he said, but you know, it's a fine balance. You have to maintain a good enough locker room with high character guys that the knuckleheads don't find one another and reproduce. And he's like, you know, more than one or two a class and they start finding one another and then they start converting the other kids to be knuckleheads and then you got a problem. And that is exactly what happened. But, you know, you can go back through his signing list and you can see that philosophy in action in terms of looking forward with the stuff that people knew in advance. There were some guys that, especially, you know, from say 2010 to 2013, they'd take like one guy, two guys in a class that you're like, you know, a little bit of a character risk. You know, Matthew Thomas was a guy that, you know, they fought for and, you know, they knew they'd have to manage, but at the same point, they felt like they could do it, that he would ultimately be a kid that would be good in their program, and he was an elite talent. You got to get that kid. So, and you know, Thomas ended up making his way through, although in fits and starts, right? And this isn't to say that Thomas is a bad kid. It's just a matter of, you know, having to manage knuckleheads, and you know, that's Jimbo's phrase, but or his word for that. But that's the kind of thing that you got to do. Now, as it turned out, I think what happened with Jimbo and his staff is that they thought once they won a national title, that they could start basically competing and signing kids like Bama. That, well, okay, we've proof of concept. Now we can basically sign the very top kids. We don't have to to, you know, we're going to be able to get this done. We don't have to do the same degree of scouting and finding some diamonds in the rough and all that. We're going to fight and we're going to go toe to toe with Bama and all the others because we showed that we can compete with them, that we can beat them, and that this is where you want to be. And then you could see time after time, Brewster would believe that he was getting that out of state guy. Jimbo was convinced that, you know, they were going to land this kid over Bama, or, you know, you'd get Dossie would get a commitment from Henry Ruggs III 3 days before signing day, before the dead period starts. And then all of a sudden other things would come into play and they wouldn't get that kid. And all of a sudden they're one or two guys short at wide receiver. And then they're, you know, a guy short at offensive line, and, you know, they don't sign the quarterback that they thought they'd get early in the process. So then they started having to, you know, there were cases where late in the process, because of this happening, they ended up having to make some reaches. And that's where they broke their own rules to some degree. They took some kids that were a little bit more character risks. And there are some of them still on this roster that I'm not going to name, but they took some kids that were more or less character risks because they were way more talented than the plan C option, but, you know, it wasn't the plan A. And then those kids did find one another and you wind up with a toxic atmosphere and environment, and that's what you get. So I think that's a big part of what led to this. And then that's also, by the way, when Jimbo started pushing even more on, like, we need to be able to compete recruiting wise with these guys, because he was always difficult in terms of, you know, being all about resources and everything. But when they won a national title, and then he still didn't feel like they could compete with the Bamas and so on for some of the guys that they were pushing for, he got upset and felt like, okay, we need to put in the Bama system. We need to do the things that are, we need to fully commit to compete with the programs that are willing to do this stuff that have all the bells and whistles and every other thing that comes with that. And ultimately that led to his dissatisfaction and him continuing to carp about these issues and ultimately him leaving. And it also led to the situation where you had a toxic locker room and he left a total mess for Willie Taggart and staff to clean up. But then when you get Willie Taggart and staff coming in, they also believed that this is Florida State. They've won a national title within the last 5 years. They've got okay, reasonably competitive resources, and they have a location that is really, really good when it comes to a huge advantage when it comes to recruiting. So they targeted kids, and you could see this with who they targeted when they first came in that first class. And they landed a couple of those guys, but they started at the very top. These are Florida State level players, and they pushed hard for those guys. And ultimately 5-7 happened. And all of a sudden, those guys are going, well, you know, you may be Florida State, but Florida State ain't Florida State. And by the time they put the requisite attention on the guys that might have been able to be really good, you know, plan A minus, those guys had already committed. Those guys were already signed in the early signing period and all of that. And that's where the early signing period complicates this a lot for a lot of staffs. I think a lot of staffs are still trying to figure out how to handle that. And what the early signing period does is, if you're going to have any staff turnover, if you have a bad season, it makes it much more difficult to recover in recruiting. In the past, you could recover in recruiting between November and February. Now those kids are gone. And so now you're scraping for some of the kids that are left that didn't sign in that early signing period. And I think this staff has still been struggling to adjust to that. And in large measure, because that happened to hit right at the time where there's a coaching change. So that affects the first sort of the 0.5 class, the beta class. Now, the first true public release class, your first class, that's affected by the on-field performance and by, you know, some of the coaching changes and all that have been taking place. So, yeah, that makes it a lot more difficult. So let's be honest, Willie Taggart and his staff were not handed a really easy situation. Because of all that, because of the combination of the bad culture in the locker room, because of the complete failure to stock that quarterback position, for them coming in because of the injury situation and the poor conditioning that had been left behind, where, you know, Vic had been asleep at the wheel for 3 years in terms of that, was more interested in talking to and hosting people in his office, you know, pro scouts and everything else, and doing all that, than he was making sure that the culture was as it should be in terms of strength and conditioning for the actual team. So, you know, all of that stuff made things much more difficult for Taggart and staff. And then you combine that with the early signing days, with this being the first time where you have to deal with that, it's much, much harder. And so, yeah, I think they thought it would be a lot easier to attract the Evan Neal type kids to Florida State. The other thing, and there's one other thing, that this is the hippo in the room, the much more dangerous animal in the room. And that's that when they got back to the Southeast, certain things had changed with the landscape in terms of how competitive, I'll be careful with how I say this, but with how competitive the marketplace is for the elite talent now, and how much that had changed even since they had gone to Oregon due to some changes in what staffs, what head coaches and so on had gone to different programs. And that has led to a ripple effect throughout the Southeast in terms of who can get what players and, you know, what it takes to get certain players. And I was told in that first class that they came in and basically were, well, let's go hard after this kid. And they were told, no, that kid, we can't actually get that kid because, and they went, whoa, seriously? It's like that? Like in a year and a half, it's like that. And yeah, it's like that. So that's another factor that, yeah, I think he thought it would be a lot easier. And I think it's justifiable that he thought it would be easier. So now they're having to make that adjustment. I think it'll be interesting to see how well they make that adjustment for the 2020 class. And that's ultimately going to be the 2019 performance on the field, which is going to impact that 2020 class, is ultimately going to be what's going to determine the success or failure of the Willie Taggart regime. So, you know, that's my take on that. In any case, next thing, Brian asked, how long do I see Blackman staying at FSU another 2 years? Or do I see him staying another three? What are the chances of him staying another 3 years? Since he's so skinny, do you think he could be a high draft pick in another 2 or 3 years? So that's an interesting question, because I do think he has potential NFL tools. Now, he would have to gain some weight. You're absolutely right about that. But it all totally depends to me. It completely depends on how successful he is. If he stays healthy and suddenly is leading this team to high numbers, to big numbers, I think he could be a 2-year guy. Just because, I mean, again, he's tall. He has the ability to push the ball down the field and all that. And NFL teams will give a look to a guy like that. Now, he's going to need to gain another 30 pounds to be really even a little bit, you know, on the skinny side for the NFL. But I think it's possible that he could be, you know, if he's a 2-year guy and that's because he goes to the NFL, then that means things went really well the next 2 years. So that would be a plus. But I think it's possible that he could be at Florida State 3 more years. It's totally possible. And I'd coin flip on that. I don't know. Then also asked, how long do I see Briles here for? 2 years max? No, actually, I think Briles is 2 years minimum. I think Briles, only way Briles leaves after 1 year is if it's a total cluster and they just completely lay another stink bomb in that year and basically the whole staff basically goes. I think that would be the most likely situation for him not to be there in year two. I think he's going to be there for 2 years, partly because, again, I don't think he gets a head coaching job after 1 year. And I don't think he's going to find a better situation, a more high profile offensive coordinator job after year one. So I think he's there 2 years minimum. Now, after 2 years, I think all bets are off. Because if he is there 2 years and they're 2 successful years, then that's a little bit further removed from Baylor and there's going to be some program that's willing to maybe give him a look. So I would say 2 years minimum for Kendall Briles. And let's be honest, Kendall Briles was the most important recruit for Florida State in this cycle. Without question, the most important recruit that they got in this cycle in terms of his impact on the program. So yeah. Then one other, actually, this looks like a comment. Other than Howell and Plumlee, Jay is the best quarterback they recruited. And yeah, I agree with that. And actually, basically he's saying Travis Jay is actually a better quarterback prospect than Lance Lejeune. And I'm not sure that that's wrong. And actually, in terms of comparing him to Plumlee, I think Plumlee's a better prospect overall, just because, you know, again, he's going to play quarterback. But if you're going to run a spread option offense and you're going to allow athleticism to dictate and all that, yeah, Jay doesn't throw it as well as Plumlee. He doesn't even throw it as well as Lejeune. But in terms of the whole package, you could make a case that Jay is the best quarterback that they recruited in this cycle, other than Howell and Plumlee. You could make a case. I think I'd probably go with one or two others that were early on their board. I thought Jaden Daniels, who ended up signing with Arizona State, was probably actually the best quarterback that they recruited this cycle. I thought he was the top prospect that I saw. I liked him better than Sam Howell, and then Howell would be the second. So yeah, it's either way, Jay is a guy that can play. Is he a guy that I want to see at quarterback? No, I want him in the secondary. He's a difference maker back there. He could be, you know, not quite Lamar Jackson type at quarterback, but you know, he's a special athlete. But I want that kind of special in my secondary, given the kind of defense that they're playing, because of his ability to lock receivers down. And with that length, given some of the receivers that they're going to be facing over the next couple of years, you look at what Clemson's collecting up there at receiver, they're going to need guys like Travis Jay in the secondary. Now, before we wrap, I want to thank Garage Makeovers as well for their sponsorship of this show. Once again, if you want anything to be done, if there's any sort of remodeling or any sort of organization, anything that you need done in your garage, they're the people to talk to in South Florida. Been serving Broward and Palm Beach counties for over a decade. They're the top rated garage remodeling company in South Florida, according to Home Advisor and Angie's List. If you need anything from them, all their information's in the show notes. Contact the Biscuit. Let him know that you heard about him from the Unconquered podcast, and he'll give you a little discount. Thanks to Troy McClure and the Unconquered Network of Realtors for their support. I also want to thank the Patreon subscribers who are at the above the Secure the Bag level. That would be Hector Cartagena, Dan Alvarez, Keith Cheney, Neil Cook, and Bert Bertoldi. As always, thanks especially to those guys and to all of you who are Patreon subscribers. Going to have some video stuff up for you guys here in the very near future, before the end of the month of January. Also going to get some a good bit of stuff up in February. Once I get my hands on just a little bit more film, we'll go through some of that. But until then, this has been
Thank you all very much and have a great day if you want to.